Case number 19-2470, Nicole Swagger versus Joel Rosette et al. Oral argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Herman for the appellant.
You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. David Herman from Armstrong Teasdale appearing on behalf of appellant Kenneth E. Reese. Your Honors, we would respectfully request to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Very well.
Thank you. Your Honors, the judgment of the district court refusing to stay and compel appellee's claims to arbitration pursuant to the written agreement to arbitrate must be reversed for two main reasons. First, and perhaps most straightforward, is that appellee's loan agreement contains both an express delegation provision in which plaintiff agreed to arbitrate any issue concerning the validity, enforceability, or scope of her loan agreement, or any dispute involving her loan agreement or her agreement to arbitrate, as well as an incorporation of the consumer arbitration rules of either JAMS or AAA at plaintiff's election. Given the presence of this clear, conspicuous, and unchallenged delegation provision, the court's decisions in Blanton v. Domino's, in which Judge Griffin, you were a member of the panel, as well as McGee versus Armstrong, in which Judge Larson was a member of the panel, as well as the Supreme Court's decision in Harry Schein, requires that the court hold plaintiff to her arbitration agreement, compel arbitration of at least threshold issues of arbitrability, and otherwise compel this case to arbitration. The second reason is that even if this court were to ignore the clear and conspicuous delegation provision, is that appellee's failure to, and her failure to challenge that provision, is that the merits of this challenge to the arbitration agreement as a whole under the prospective waiver doctrine is prohibited by this court's decision in Shell versus Sturge. And that's important, Your Honor, because under that case, the mere allegation that a contract selects the laws of a forum or a sovereign that is different than the federal or state sovereign that appellee would prefer is not a basis to invalidate the claims at issue and is not a valid basis.
Counsel, every court of appeals to look at this question, at that question so far, has rejected that conclusion. So aren't you facing a little bit of an uphill battle on that front?
Well, Your Honor, this court must reach a different conclusion for two main reasons. The first is that, as I said in my first argument, in the first position, is that the decision in Henry Schein, as well as Blanton and McGee, required that this court enforce the delegation provision first. And so that issue is properly reserved for the arbitrator. And the arbitrator may agree with that position. The arbitrator may say the same as all these other courts of appeals have said, although we disagree with those decisions, and we think there are bases to differentiate them. But that's for the arbitrator, and that's properly reserved for the arbitrator, Your Honor. Moreover, what we have in the Sixth Circuit is the Shell case. And the Shell case very clearly says that merely selecting the laws of a different sovereign, in this case, the Native American sovereign, is not a basis to apply the prospective waiver doctrine. And what we see, Your Honor, is in the Shell case, there were remedies available under foreign law that are identical to the remedies available here under tribal law. And for that reason, it's different. But if you look at those decisions, Your Honor, the ones that have gone against us, look at Gibbs most recently out of the Fourth Circuit. And what Gibbs said was, we apply the prospective waiver doctrine solely because the plaintiffs can't assert a RICO claim. Well, that position has been rejected by this court in Shell. It's been rejected by the Ninth Circuit earlier in the Richards case en banc. It's been rejected in the Second Circuit in the Roby case. And so what we would say, Your Honor, is under this court's binding precedent, which it must follow, the mere inability to assert a specific claim is not a basis to invoke the prospective waiver doctrine. It's only where there are no remedies available, no reasonable remedies available in the foreign forum under the Shell case is when the prospective waiver doctrine can be applied by this court. And Your Honors, that brings me back to my first argument. The first argument is here, we have a delegation provision. That delegation provision has never been challenged by appellee. That delegation provision is enforceable. It reads almost effectively the same as the delegation provisions in the Rent-A-Center case. And we have an incorporation of the AAA rules or the JAMS rules, consumer rules. And in that case, what we have is a case that is effectively the same as what this court considered just recently in Blanton. And in Blanton, Your Honor, what we had was a court, or a case where the defendants sought to compel arbitration, including the national franchisor Domino's Pizza. Domino's Pizza had no arbitration agreement with the litigant there. They weren't a party to that arbitration agreement, but they were seeking to enforce it. And what this court held there was a non-signatory to an arbitration agreement can still compel arbitration agreement, at least on threshold issues of delegation and on arbitrability, in the presence of a delegation clause. So there's really no gap between what the court held in Blanton and what we have here. Indeed, Your Honors, the only thing that is in any way different between this case and Blanton is that that was contained in an employment contract and the franchisor wasn't a party to that employment contract. And here, Mr. Reese is alleged to be a mastermind, is alleged to have all these allegations against him. And we disagree with those allegations, but they're alleged that he's incorporated and he's controlling this entire enterprise. We disagree with that.
Counsel, I know that argument has been raised on appeal that third parties cannot benefit from an arbitration agreement. And I know that Domino's Pizza, I was on that case, holds that they may. It's up to the arbitrator. Was that issue raised below? And I know it's raised on appeal, but was that raised? I don't remember the district court addressing it.
The district court did not address it. It was raised below in that Mr. Falk, on behalf of Appellees, did argue that Mr. Reese was unable to enforce this arbitration agreement. But, Your Honors, the court below did not in any way address that. But your review, Your Honor, is de novo, and you can affirm for any matter as of record.
Sure. Okay.
So, Your Honor, you hit it exactly on the head, which is Domino's holds that Mr. Reese's mere status as a non-party in the presence of a delegation provision, which is, again, unchallenged. It's unchallenged below. It's unchallenged here. The effect of it is unchallenged. Its presence is unchallenged. And so this court, before it reaches any prospective waiver issues, must compel this case to arbitration for issues of arbitrability, including what... Go ahead, Your Honor.
The whole reason for that is the Rent-A-Center case, correct? That
yes, Your Honor.
The Rent-A-Center case says that if you don't challenge to the overall agreement, arbitration agreement is not sufficient, you have to specifically challenge the delegation clause.
Yes, Your Honor. And in fact, I would also give credit to Judge Griffin, who authored the opinion in Encore Capital, which reached the same conclusion. It was an unpublished decision, but we cited it in our reply brief. And Judge Griffin reached the same exact conclusion looking to Rent-A-Center. So, Your Honors, remember what we're talking about here on a delegation provision. It's not about the merits. It's not even about whether the parties have agreed to arbitrate the merits. The only issue is who should decide whether the parties have agreed to arbitrate the merits. And under Schein, under Blanton, and under McGee, this court must compel arbitration of at least those threshold issues.
Yeah, so, let me ask you this question. Why is it that you chose to incorporate tribal law and have your arbitration agreement be governed by tribal law? Why not operate under the laws of the United States or a state? Why did you choose to incorporate under tribal law?
Well, Your Honor, I would respectfully challenge your premise there for one reason. Mr. Reese didn't select tribal law. The lender with whom Appellee took out her loan, who was originally a defendant in the case below, or at least their officers were a defendant, selected tribal law because they're members of a tribe. This is an arm of the tribe case. The lender selected the laws of its home state effectively. And what it said was, just as the same as a lender in Utah might select the laws of Utah, we want our laws to apply. Now, Native American, I have no time here to get into the years of treatment, but they don't necessarily trust the laws of other sovereigns. They have an ability, and Congress has not regulated in this area. They have a sovereignty that they can enact their own laws. So that's why, Your Honor, they selected these laws. And that's important because it's no different than any other lender saying, I want my own home state's laws to apply. And courts repeatedly uphold those challenges. But if Your Honor has any concern, the Chippewa Cree law does specifically incorporate federal law, and that's the Gunson case, but it also says that consumers have a right to file complaints with the Consumer Tribal Protection Bureau alleging any violations of federal law, that violations of federal law are recognized and that all regulated parties must comply with federal law. So it's really a false equivalency to say that federal law isn't here. It is. It just is incorporated under tribal law. So, Your Honors, in the presence of this delegation provision, I just want to sum up and say the Blanton case, Henry Schein, and McGee control here. There's been no challenge to the delegation provision, and therefore, at least under Rent-A-Center, Blanton, and others, this case must be compelled to arbitration, regardless of how the court feels about any issues as to prospective waiver. But even if this court were to say that the delegation provision didn't exist, or it had been challenged, or there was a successful challenge, and I want to make clear, even if they had challenged it, there's no specific challenge and there's no basis to apply prospective waiver to the delegation provision. And that's the only challenge that's been raised anywhere. But even if this court were to ignore the delegation provision and move directly on to the prospective waiver issues, again, I return to where I started, which is the Shell case requires a different outcome here. And the Shell case, what we had were litigants saying, we don't want to bring, or we can't bring our state and federal claims under securities laws in an English court. There are immunities that English law has given to certain Lloyd's of London affiliates and syndicates. There are fewer remedies, and we can't even bring our claims for specific remedies under Ohio securities laws, which say you must disclose X or Y. The only claims they could bring under English law were claims for deceit or otherwise bad acts or bad faith acts. Well, what the court here in Shell said was, what the court here in Shell said was that those remedies under English law, even if they weren't the same remedies, even if they weren't identical to what plaintiffs wanted to bring, that's not enough to trigger prospective waiver. They could still effectively vindicate those claims. And Your Honor, we have the same thing here. In Shell, they could bring claims for injunctive relief, for rescission, for restitution. Well, those same provisions and those same types of remedies are available under Chippewa Cree law. That's section 10.6201 of the Chippewa Cree law. That's at page ID 493, record entry 9-5. And so, Your Honors, there's no gap between the remedies that were available in Shell versus the remedies that are available under Chippewa Cree law. And so, Your Honors, under that decision in Shell, the only basis for this court to reach a different conclusion is for this court to say there's some inherent difference between the laws of England and the sovereign of England and the laws of the Chippewa Cree tribe, which are a sovereign that predates the Constitution, which have the rights to make their own laws unless regulated by Congress. And Congress has not chosen to legislate here. So what we have, Your Honor, is an identical case. And I would close on this point by saying, in the FTC v. Payday Financial case out of the District of South Dakota, the court said it was, I apologize, I'm out of time, Your Honor. May I briefly finish?
Yes, please. I've got an additional question for you after that, too.
Of course, Your Honor. What the court in Payday Financial said, Your Honors, was it would be paradoxical for courts to treat the laws of a Native American sovereign different than the laws of any other international sovereign. And so for that reason, Your Honor, there's no reason to treat Chippewa Cree law differently. The remedies are the same, and there's no basis to apply prospective waiver under this court's binding decision in Shell.
Okay, the only reason given by the district court to deny the motion to compel arbitration was collateral estoppel based upon the Second Circuit decision. And that goes to the merits. And your position is that the collateral estoppel issue on the merits should be decided by the arbitrator, and it was improper for the district court to decide it in the first instance.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
All right.
But even if this court were to do so, the appellee has not met the elements of collateral estoppel. That's in our brief, and I won't burden the court with that. But we don't believe the appellee has met her burden to demonstrate that collateral estoppel applies here.
All right. But you would argue that issue in front of the arbitrator, whether collateral.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. Any further questions, Judge Cook?
No, thank you.
Judge Larson?
Thank you, Your Honor.
No.
All right. Mr. Falk, good to see you again. It's been a long time. Yeah, it's been a long time. So I'm glad to see that you're still practicing and still doing a good job. And anyway, you've got 15 minutes. So let's hear from you.
Thank you. May it please the court, Alan Falk on behalf of Nicole Swiger. At the outset, allow me to mention some late developments not cited in our brief. On July 21st, 2020, the Fourth Circuit ruled in Gibbs versus Sequoia Capital, which Mr. Herman referenced, but he didn't cite it in his reply brief. That's 966 F3rd 286. Again, held this exact arbitration clause invalid under the prospective waiver doctrine. The same date, the same panel affirmed Judge Hannah Lauck's ruling, which is referred to in our brief, in Gibbs versus Haynes Investments. That's, I don't have a Fed Third site for that. That's a Third Circuit case number 19-1434, which also involved the plain green arbitration clause. The Gibbs case, Mr. Herman's firm, Armstrong Teasdale, was counsel of record in the, in the Sequoia case. They're both Gibbs. In the Haynes Investment case, the amicus, Native American Rights Fund, was also amicus.
Mr. Falk.
Yes.
Mr. Herman will tell us that that is quite different. Isn't it? Is that the citation that you're giving us in this authority probably involves a different situation with respect to arbitration? Am I correct? When Mr. Herman talks again, he's going to tell us, forget what Mr. Falk just said.
I don't know what's different about it. It involves exactly the plain green arbitration agreement. I'll note in his reply brief, Mr. Herman argued that plain green has used a variety of different arbitration formulations and every case must be different, but he didn't introduce a different arbitration agreement.
So it has the same delegation clause.
Pardon?
It has the same delegation clause.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, and did there was a challenge to the delegation clause because it was decided by a court, not an arbitrator, correct?
Yes. Yeah, they went through the whole thing about, you know, who decides this, the arbitrator or the court, and they said no, when arbitration itself is challenged, it's the court.
Gotcha. And the plaintiff there challenged the arbitration clause.
Yes.
I mean,
it's the same as we did.
You didn't challenge the, apparently, as far as I know, your briefing never mentions the delegation clause.
Well, there's no delegation clause in the agreement itself. I think he's referring to the fact that if you look at the rules of the AAA or JAMS that, you know, there's something in there that says the arbitrator decides arbitrability. But other than that,
doesn't this arbitration agreement incorporate a reference anyway, JAMS and the?
Well, it just says you can choose your arbitrator from one of these two groups, and then you'll be subject
without having the substantive requirements. Then it
doesn't repeat them anywhere.
So it's your position that the contract, the arbitration agreement itself, contains no delegation clause.
I don't think so.
That's your answer to Rent-A-Center. There was no delegation clause for me to challenge.
Well, I mean, other than what's in the rules of the AAA. But remember, you know, this agreement also says the Federal Arbitration Act doesn't really apply. It's just a guide. You know, we get to use it as a guide, but we're going to follow tribal law, whatever that is. And you know, if tribal law conflicts with the Federal Arbitration Act or anything else, then tribal law dominates. So the whole idea that we're discussing cases that arose under the Federal Arbitration Act really isn't applicable here. This is not an arbitration agreement subject to the Federal Arbitration Act. That's a big problem for them. I'm sorry, I misspoke when I spoke of the Third Circuit. That was a different named case. That's Williams versus Medley Opportunity Fund 2. That was decided on July 14th. And I do have a site for that, 965 Fed 3rd, 229. The other number I gave you was a Fourth Circuit companion case. And this is the one where the amicus appeared. Mr. Reese also argues that as a non-signatory, he not only has a right to arbitrate, but that Plaintiff Swiger is somehow collaterally estopped from contending otherwise. That's an unpreserved argument, which is not permitted by this court's decisions in Speedy on Data versus integrated direct marketing. That's 718 Federal Appendix 333 at 338. And those cases hold as such an argument is forfeited. But it's also a proposition for which Mr. Reese cites no authority. Meanwhile, Reese continues to ignore the clear language of the actual arbitration agreement, that arbitration is between you, meaning the borrower, and any heirs, guardians, etc., and Plain Green, meaning Plain Green as the lender, Plain Green's affiliated companies, the tribe, Plain Green's servicing and collection representatives and agents, and each of their respective agents, representatives, etc., and Mr. Reese is none of those things. He's been at pains to represent. He has had no affiliation with Plain Green or Think Finance or any other Plain Green servicing or collection representative for several years before Ms. Swiger borrowed money from Plain Green. So all other considerations aside, Mr. Reese is neither a party to the arbitration agreement nor within its scope. And he has no standing as a third party beneficiary under the Michigan statute cited in our brief. Undeterred, he cites an unpublished Michigan Court of Appeals decision for the notion that non-signatories can claim a right to arbitrate. But as explained in our brief, Michigan Supreme Court's holding in Beck versus Park West Galleries, a party cannot be compelled to arbitrate anything she has not agreed to arbitrate or with anyone she hasn't agreed to arbitrate. In reply, Reese urges that Beck should be confined to its limited facts, but as this court surely knows, the Michigan Supreme Court not only represents a stalwart proponent of the principle of freedom of contract, which says that parties are not only free to make a contract that is legal, but the court will enforce it according to its terms. It won't make a new contract for them. And in addition to that, the Michigan Supreme Court for a long time has had a principle that precedents are not confined to their very specific facts, which is what Mr. Reese urges you to do. Case for that proposition is Hoffman versus Burkhead, 353 Michigan 47 or 90 Northwest 2nd, 498 at page 502. And then turning to the collateral estoppel, on page 22 of his reply brief, Mr. Reese contends that Michigan law as to collateral estoppel applies, and he cites pure diversity cases, but this is not a pure diversity case. We have five different federal causes of action in this case. Counts 1 through 4 are all based on RICO, count 7 on the Declaratory Judgment Act, and count 8 on the Electronic Funds Transfer Act. On page 23 of his reply brief, Mr. Reese contends the Second Circuit's Gingras decision cannot have collateral estoppel effect because it involved a differently worded Plain Green arbitration clause. But he had a chance to provide the trial court with a copy of that supposedly differently written arbitration agreement, and it wasn't one of his five exhibits. Four exhibits. So he's arguing, he wants his court to speculate what the arbitration agreement in Gingras says. All we know is that it involved Plain Green, and you know, we've contended that it reads the same. You know, whether somebody changed a comma somewhere, we don't care.
Hey, can I interrupt?
Go ahead, Judge Cook.
Thank you. I asked you about there being a delegation clause.
Right.
And we talk about this, and you heard your brother counsel mention, your briefing never mentions the delegation clause. And I think you and I both will agree that we mean delegate to the arbitrator the duties, particular duties, right? Yes?
Okay. All right.
Okay. And so what about, as you well know, the arbitration provision that states the term dispute is to be given its broadest possible meaning and specifically includes any claim or controversy. And also the contract also includes a clause which delegates to the arbitrator to resolve any issue concerning the validity, enforceability, and scope of this agreement. Okay, so that's the argument that you're being faced with by the appellant here. And that's the one I'm afraid we're not hearing a response to.
Okay, well, my response is the agreement also says the Federal Arbitration Act doesn't apply, so whatever
that is
you
that
have on delegation provisions
stop,
on the FAA doesn't apply.
Hey, stop. Is that your answer, that you view it as conflicting with another aspect, a very general statement in the contract? That's your response to the argument that you hear from Mr. Herman? That's your response is that it says in another portion the FAA doesn't apply.
Well, yes, that is, yes, I don't think that's a very general provision. I mean, it says, you know,
in other aspects,
the tribal court might look to the FAA for guidance, whatever that means, but it means the FAA clearly doesn't apply by its terms.
There's a specific provision in the agreement that says any issue concerning the validity, enforceability, or scope of this agreement or this agreement to arbitrate is a dispute, and all disputes go to arbitration. I mean, the agreement says that. That's a delegation clause to the arbitrator. Okay.
And the Third and Fourth Circuit had the same exact language in front of them and came to the same conclusion that the
But in those cases, there was I believe, and you can tell me if I'm wrong, there was a challenge to that delegation provision. And according to the Rent-A-Center case by the Supreme Court, it's not sufficient to challenge the validity of the agreement as a whole. You have to challenge that delegation clause. Now, that varies. You have to say this delegation clause isn't valid, even if your reasons are exactly the same as your reasons for your challenge to the whole agreement. Now, you can say maybe that doesn't make sense or whatever you want to say about that, but that is what the Supreme Court said as I read Rent-A-Center. So I have to apply Rent-A-Center.
I'm sorry, I would have to look at Gibbs and the Third Circuit case to see exactly whether that's correct or not.
We'll do that too. But regardless of what other circuits have said, what I'm struggling with is the Supreme Court, which is my boss, has said you must challenge the delegation clause specifically.
Well, I thought we did that, but if you say we didn't, then we didn't.
So is it too late? I mean,
I don't know why you would remand this case. So I would then challenge it specifically in front of the district court on remand. If it all has to do with my failing to do that.
I mean, you'd need leave from the district court to amend your complaint, presumably.
Well, do I need to challenge it in the complaint or just in response to their motion to compel arbitration?
Well, I'm not entirely sure about that. I suggest
on
that question.
Okay, but you know, I'm sure you know. Then I'll file a motion to amend. If I have to. I mean, it doesn't seem to me like this is a huge barrier to anything. We've wasted a lot of time here. I don't mean in the courtroom. I meant, you know, waiting for our turn just to go back and have me say, I'm sorry, you know, okay, I want to specifically challenge the delegation clause.
So the Supreme Court of the United States said that's what you have to do. As far as
I understand.
If you can't tell me how to read Rent-A-Center differently or tell me why your agreement doesn't fall within the confines of Rent-A-Center, I feel like my hands are pretty tied. So maybe you can explain it to me, but if you can't,
Well, let me just take a quick look at my brief and see what I said about Rent-A-Center.
Well, that was my point earlier, counsel. Your brief, I think, is not the words delegation clause never appear in your brief. And even though the argument was posed by the appellant's brief, so you failed to respond to it or even acknowledge it. And now you're thinking, oh, let me amend. But you really had your chance, counsel.
Well, the words delegation provision appear in quotation marks on line one of page 25 of my brief. That's all I can tell you.
Did it? Okay, I'll look for that. Was it accompanied by some argument?
It's accompanied by a citation of the Rent-A-Center case.
Okay, but. And there must have been some point to be made.
But I will freely admit that I may have not understood the argument he was making at the time.
Alrighty.
I may not have seen it that way. Finally, I just want to point out that their argument that Gingras doesn't have collateral estoppel effect is because supposedly the Second Circuit didn't spend enough time discussing all their arguments. And I don't think that's part of collateral estoppel at all. It's not an element. They don't cite any authority for that proposition. They just make the argument, oh, well, if the Second Circuit didn't give us a certain number of words, it doesn't count. My time is up.
Yeah, Mr. Falk, you know, your defenses may prevail, but I think the main issue here, at least for me, is who decides the merits of your claim. Is it the court or is it the arbitrator? And I personally would, if it is for the arbitrator to decide the merits, I would not express any opinion on your defenses of collateral estoppel or the federal law, prospective waiver defense, which I think, you know, your defenses may have merit, but I think the threshold issue is who decides it. And I think that's what we're grappling with. So any further questions, Judge Larson, Judge Cook?
Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Herman, you've got 2 minutes rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, I think you have hit it directly on the head, which is there's no challenge to the delegation provision. There is, as Judge Cook and Judge Larson recognize, an express delegation provision, as well as an incorporation of the AAA rules. That's at page ID 16 of the record below. And Judge Larson, you asked, is it too late? Well, yes, it is. It is too late. This court, what it would do is it would say, it wouldn't remand for further proceedings. It would say, remand and compel to arbitration, because we've reviewed this de novo and Mr. Falk didn't raise an argument. So it is too late.
Okay, the AAA rules, I think, my understanding, also has a broad delegation of power to the arbitrator to decide what is subject to arbitration.
Absolutely. I
mean, it doesn't conflict with the arbitration clause here, does it?
It does not in any way. And Your Honors, if you look to the Uroma case out of district court in Kentucky, it said exactly this, which is the arbitrator is free to decide choice of law issues in a tribal law case exactly like this, and merely citing to other tribal law cases and saying they found it different doesn't satisfy your burden.
Okay. So after the practicality of this, as it would under your argument, we would reverse the district court's decision to deny arbitration, direct the case to go to arbitration. After arbitration, Mr. Falk's clients have an opportunity to go back to district court and challenge the arbitration.
No, 100%, Your Honors. Under Section 10 of the FAA, there is always back-end review. And Your Honors, I just want to correct one thing that Mr. Falk said, even as my brother counsel, I just want to make sure. At record site pages 15 and 17, these arbitration agreements invoke and require, and I'm quoting, application of the Federal Arbitration Act, as well as, quote, judicial interpretations thereof. So the FAA clearly applies here and clearly requires that these prospective waiver cases or any other FAA cases, I see my time is up, may I briefly conclude?
Mr. Herman, just, I wondered, counsel's telling us that the agreement also said at another place in the document that the FAA did not apply. He's probably correct about that.
Your Honor, what the documents say, and they speak for themselves, and they're you can review them at record pages 15 to 17.
But you say the time, okay? Go ahead.
Yeah. But Your Honors, they very clearly say require application. And what Mr. Falk is saying is that there's a provision that's a little wishy-washy that says requires application of in judicial interpretations of the FAA. Well, if there's any doubt, Your Honors, in regards to whether or not it applies, you must compel arbitration. And that's what the Supreme Court and this court has said over and over again.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. And for these reasons.
Any further questions? Judge Larson?
I want to hear the conclusion. For these reasons, what?
Your Honors must compel, reverse the district court below, compel arbitration. And if there are any issues, they can be raised on the back end. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right. Normally I don't do this, but Mr. Falk, you said there's no back end review of this.
I don't see how there can be, because it says it's only reviewed by a tribal court, and I don't know where you go from tribal court.
Okay.
But tribal court applies tribal law, so a federal court saying the tribal court incorrectly applied tribal law seems unlikely.
All right. How do you respond to that?
Any jurisdiction.
All right. Mr. Herman, how do you respond to that?
Your Honor, the response there is that back-end review is a statutory construction by Section 10 of the FAA. The district court would retain jurisdiction over this case. And even if there is intermediate appellate review by a tribal court, that's no different than intermediate appellate review that's available in the AAA or JAMS. All these arbitral associations contain similar intermediate review, but they always go back under Section 10 of the FAA to the district court for back-end review. Always. It's a statutory construction.
All right. All right. Any further questions, Judge Larson, Judge Cook? All right. Thank you, counsel, for your arguments.
Thank you.
Case will be submitted.